Devin Almonte here. Welcome. This is Insight Out, where we learn to look at our faith from God's eyes and figure out how to live that out in our everyday. On July 4th, while families across the country were getting ready and gearing up for the holiday weekend, tragedy struck the Texas Hill Country. The Guadalupe River rose more than 20 feet in just a few hours' time, flooding entire communities, turning a nearly 100-year-old Christian girls' summer camp into a scene of horror and unimaginable loss. And like you, I have been heartbroken watching this unfold. The grief, it's overwhelming and immense. And to think that many of these families, the wait is still not over. And there's something else that surfaced in the wake of this tragedy. And I think we need to talk about it, because almost as fast as the water rose, all the finger pointing began, all the blame, saying it was this person, it was that person, it was this agency, it was this thing. I get it. I think that's a very normal human reaction and response. We tend to reach for control when we feel out of control. But this really reveals something deep about us, important about who we are, about our fallen nature, and our need for something steadier than blame. So I want to look at why we go there so quickly and what the Bible shows us about crisis, suffering, pain, loss, living in this broken world, and how we can, as believers, respond differently, have a different type of reaction, even when things are falling apart and tragic. And before we go any further into this, I do just want to invite you to pray today that just for these families in Texas still waiting to hear if their children are coming home. There's still lives missing. The communities are hurting and grieving. So as you're listening right now, wherever you are, let's lift them up in prayer. So to go back a second, just to walk through what happened, this was on July 4th, early, early morning. The Guadalupe River, which is known for flooding, it's still a great place to hang out. Summertime, tubing, all the water activities, it's a great place to be when it's safe. But a few days before the holiday, reports were coming in that a storm was coming, bad weather, there's some weather alerts, flood warnings. But nobody expected that water to rise 22 feet in less than 2 hours' time. By 4:30 in the morning, it had nearly tripled. Camp Mystic is the Christian girls' summer camp that I mentioned. It's been around for decades. It sits right there on the riverbank. There were, I think, about 750 kids at this camp when the flood hit. It completely took them by surprise, overwhelmed them. At least 111 people are now dead from this tragedy. And despite all the efforts from counselors and staff, 27 campers and leaders were swept away, and 10 are still missing. So that was at Camp Mystic, but entire neighborhoods across Hill Country were just destroyed by the water. Homes, families, communities displaced and broken. Then we try to sit and make sense of it all. And what often follows tragedy is blame. This time it happened almost immediately.
Some local officials say the National Weather Service underestimated the extreme rain.
It did not predict the amount of rain that we saw.
And you've got a connection for us, David, between climate change and what happened in Kerrville. A lot of people wondering, is there a direct connection? Help us understand from your point of view how it may or may not have played a role.
Well, there's a very clear connection between climate change and the extreme weather that we get now, which is more extreme, more fires, more floods, more droughts.
Where was the WCM, the Warning Coordination Meteorologist? I am convinced that the staff cuts that we saw were a contributing factor to the inability of the emergency managers to respond.
In this case, I think it was a failure to execute the warning and the notification of the campers along the river. And of course, the explanation is that they don't have sirens and they don't have long-range radios, backup communications.
And finally tonight, in these confusing times, you might have seen posts or videos connecting cloud seeding to what is happening in Texas. And then earlier tonight, the CEO of a weather modification company confirmed that planes in Texas did release silver iode into the atmosphere.
What do we have in there? Climate change, politics, cloud seeding, camps to blame, local officials, the weather service, blame, 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 blame. You've probably heard of the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. I noticed that there's a similar rhythm, I guess you could call it, when we're in crisis. So it's not stages of grief. It's almost like the stages of crisis. And there are five of them. At least this is how I see it. This isn't anything official, at least that I know of. The first one, we've got impact. Impact is that moment when crisis hits. The river flooding, you get a bad diagnosis, you find out a loved one was in a car accident. It's that frozen moment of shock. Then we move to the rescue phase. This is where adrenaline kicks in. We start to mobilize, teams start to mobilize, go in and rescue people, try to save them from the river. We do everything that we can to help. It's saving mode. After that, we have what I call the honeymoon phase. And this is where, I mean, it's a beautiful phase. It's where all the support starts to come in, food donations, people are bringing water, helping financially, opening up their homes, praying for one another. And it's this really strong sense of unity and that we will get through this together. The best of humanity in those moments, if you ask me. At some point, that may wear off and we find ourselves in the disillusioned blame phase. That's when I think reality sets in. Tired, there are delays, a lot of red tape, their bills, promises are broken and forgotten. People who said they would never start suing are suing. We start to blame the meteorologist. We blame the doctors for the misdiagnosis. We blame the camp for not having the right protocols in place. We'll even blame God. We often blame God. And then the last phase is the rebuild. This is when we start to pick up the pieces, almost like the acceptance phase of grief. We start to find a new normal. We start to heal. But this time, and maybe in the last couple of years, I feel like this phase has shifted its order. Blame, which typically I would say is the fourth stage of a crisis response, that's now showing up in the first and second phase, the moment of impact where we discover what's happening, we're overwhelmed by that, and also the rescue where we're trying to just save and pick up the pieces and we're dropping everything to help. I blame media for that and the social platforms because we're seeing everything in real time from people that aren't even in the situation, pointing fingers. The outrage is happening while rescue boats are still in the water. And all of that outrage starts to pick up steam online because of the algorithm. So they become the loudest voice of the tragedy, and we lose the person behind it. That's what started to happen in Texas. Camp Mystic should have had warning signs. The local officials are to blame. It was cloud seeding. It was the National Weather Service. I do not want this to come off making light of the situation, but have you ever heard the old lady who swallowed a fly?
She swallowed the cow to catch the dog. She swallowed the dog to catch the cat. She swallowed the cat to catch the bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and tickled.
That's what the blame and outrage sounds like to me. It's one threat after another while people are still searching for their loved ones. They're still in the rescue phase. Blame is a terrible substitute for restoration. So why do we blame? Why do we do this? Why is our first instinct to point fingers when tragedy happens? First, I think we crave meaning in chaos. It's easier to believe somebody made the mistake than to accept that nature can be wild and untamable. So blame ends up giving us a framework. It creates order out of something that has no order. I think we blame because we want to feel safe. And if we can blame someone, a builder, a doctor, a camp director, we can then convince ourselves, well, it won't happen to us. That home collapsed because they used a bad contractor. That's why. Or the child died because a doctor misdiagnosed. It's like a form of emotional self-protection because the alternative to that is to realize that tragedy can strike even when we do everything right. And that terrifies us. We also have deeply embedded in us a sense of justice, of right and wrong. We care about right and wrong. So when something terrible happens, our minds immediately ask, well, who failed? Who should be held accountable for this? And even if no one truly caused it, we still want someone to answer for it. blame gives us a sense of control. When we are helpless, blame feels like something we can do. It's almost like an action we can take. Easier to accuse than to sit with our own grief. All of that is a deeply human response, but it's also one that Jesus challenges. In John 9, when the disciples encountered a man who was born blind, they asked, "Rabbi, who sinned? Who's to blame here for his blindness? Is it the man? Is it his parents? Tell us, like, what's the reason?" And Jesus replies, "Neither. It's not the man or his parents. This happens so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Not all suffering is punishment, and not all tragedy is going to have somebody to blame. Sometimes it just is. And that's what I think we wrestle with, because it is showing us that we live in a world that isn't as it was meant to be. 2 Corinthians 5:4 says, "For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed instead with our heavenly dwelling." That's what we want. It's this longing, this ache for a world as it was meant to be. This doesn't mean we just shrug our shoulders and go, "Oh, well, you know, it's tragedy. What are you going to do? Move on." And I don't think that's how we should handle it at all. Human responsibility matters. People should absolutely be held accountable for their decisions and choices, especially when negligence plays a role. Scripture talks about this too. If someone digs a pit and fails to cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls in, the one who opened the pit must make restitution. That's from Exodus 21. Responsibility matters. Accountability matters. Leadership, emergency preparedness, stewardship, it matters. But it's the fine line where if we make everything about blame and human failure, we risk missing the bigger story, what might be something deeper about our nature. Because the truth is, sometimes I don't think we're so much annoyed that people failed and that's the problem. I think we're afraid that we're not in control and that no amount of planning or preparation that we do can protect us completely. That's scary. Life's fragile. We don't like that aspect of it. It unsettles us. We spend our whole lives trying to avoid that discomfort, but somewhere in our souls, we know that we were made for more. Our blame is really a misdirected search for Eden, and we are white-knuckling our way, trying to make the best attempts to recreate it through security, systems, more weather control, and when it falls apart, we reach for blame, just like Eve did. Earthquakes are going to shake. The storms are going to hit. Tragedies come, not because somebody failed, but because this is a broken world. The whole creation has been groaning. It's in the floods. It's in the loss. It's in the ache for things to be made right again. Yes, we can and should ask good questions. Should the camp have had sirens? Did the officials miss a warning sign? Do we need better emergency protocols? These are all fair, but they are not the whole story. When these things fall apart, and they will, our response will reveal what we believe about the world, what we believe about people, and what we believe about Jesus Christ. Much of the time, our response shows how desperate we are for somebody, anybody, to carry the weight of what feels unbearable. That's what it means to live east of Eden. I want to leave you with a quote from Charles Spurgeon from my devotional this week. It was very timely. The devotional, if you're interested, I love it. It's called Morning and Evening, the classic daily devotional by Charles Spurgeon. "Amid the wreck of worlds, the believer shall be as secure as in the calmest hour of rest. If God cannot save his people under heaven, he will save them in heaven. If the world becomes too hot to hold them, then heaven shall be their place of their reception and their safety." So if the weight of all of this feels too much to carry today, rest in this, that God sees, God knows, God holds. Even when the world is not as it should be, Christ is still who he has always been and will always be. Okay, well, if you heard something that you liked today, go ahead and share the episode, like the episode, all of that helps. Don't forget to connect with me on social. You can find me on Facebook at insightout.media. I also have a private Facebook group there where we can connect, offer prayer for one another, just do life together. Remember, we have a choice in where we find our peace. Let's choose wisely. And now let's go live Insight Out.
Thank you.